Chapter 6, Mr. Victor Hazel. The following Friday, while we were having supper in the caravan, my father said, "If it's all right with you, Danny, I'll be going out again tomorrow night."
"You mean poaching?"
"Yes."
"Will it be Hazel's Wood again?"
"It'll always be Hazel's Wood," he said. "First, because that's where all the pheasants are. And second, because I don't like Mr. Hazel one little bit. And it's a pleasure to poach his birds."
I must pause here to tell you something about Mr. Victor Hazel. He was a brewer of beer and he owned a huge brewery. He was rich beyond words and his property stretched for miles along either side of the valley. All the land around us belonged to him. Everything on both sides of the road. Everything except the small patch of ground on which our filling station stood. That patch belonged to my father. It was a little island in the middle of the vast ocean of Mr. Hazel's estate. Mr. Victor Hazel was a roaring snob, and he tried desperately to get in with what he believed were the right kind of people. He hunted with the hounds and gave shooting parties and wore fancy waistcoats. Every weekday he drove his enormous silver Rolls Royce past our filling station on his way to the brewery. As he flashed by, we could sometimes catch a glimpse of the great glistening beery face above the wheel, pink as a ham, all soft and inflamed from drinking too much beer. "No," my father said, "I do not like Mr. Victor Hazel one little bit. I haven't forgotten the way he spoke to you last year when he came in for a fill-up." I hadn't forgotten it either. Mr. Hazel had pulled up alongside the pumps in his glistening, gleaming Rolls Royce and had said to me, "Fill her up and look sharp about it." I was 8 years old at the time. He didn't get out of the car. He just handed me the key to the cap of the petrol tank. And as he did so, he barked out, "And keep your filthy little hands to yourself. Do you understand?" I didn't understand at all. So I said, "What do you mean, sir?" There was a leather riding crop on the seat beside him. He picked it up and pointed it at me like a pistol. "If you make any dirty finger marks on my paintwork," he said, "I'll step right out of this car and give you a good hiding." My father was out of the workshop almost before Mr. Hazel had finished speaking. He strode up to the window of the car and placed his hands on the sill and leaned in. "I don't like you speaking to my son like that," he said. His voice was dangerously soft. Mr. Hazel did not look at him. He sat quite still in the seat of his Rolls Royce, his tiny piggy eyes staring straight ahead. There was a smug, superior little smile around the corners of his mouth. "You had no reason to threaten him," my father went on. "He had done nothing wrong." Mr. Hazel continued to act as though my father wasn't there. "Next time you threaten someone with a good hiding, I suggest you pick a person your own size," my father said. "Like me, for instance." Mr. Hazel still did not move. "Now, go away, please," my father said. "We do not wish to serve you." He took the key from my hand and tossed it through the window. The Rolls Royce drove away in a cloud of dust. The very next day, an inspector from the local Department of Health arrived and said he had come to inspect our caravan. "What do you want to inspect our caravan for?" my father asked.
"To see if it's a fit place for humans to live in," the man said. "We don't allow people to live in dirty, broken-down shacks these days."
My father showed him the inside of the caravan, which was spotlessly clean as always and as cosy as can be. And in the end, the man had to admit that there was nothing wrong with it. Soon after that, another inspector turned up and took a sample of petrol from one of our underground storage tanks. My father explained to me that they were checking up to see if we were mixing some of our second grade petrol in with the first grade stuff, which is an old dodge practiced by crooked filling station owners. Of course, we weren't doing this. Hardly a week went by without some local official dropping in to check up on one thing or another. And there was little doubt, my father said, that the long and powerful arm of Mr. Hazel was reaching out behind the scenes and trying to run us off our land. So, all in all, you can see why it gave my father a certain pleasure to poach Mr. Victor Hazel's pheasants. That night, we put the raisins in to soak. The next day was poaching day, and don't think my father didn't know it. From the moment he got out of his bunk in the morning, the excitement began to build up inside him. This was a Saturday, so I was home from school and we spent most of the day in the workshop decarbonising the cylinders of Mr. Pratchett's Austin 7. It was a great little car, built in 1933. A tiny miracle of a machine that still ran as sweetly as ever, even though it was more than 40 years old now. My father said that these Austin 7s, better known in their time as Baby Austins, were the first successful minicars ever made. Mr. Pratchett, who owned a turkey farm near Aylesbury, was as proud as could be of this one, and he always brought it to us for repair. Working together, we released the valve springs and drew out the valves. We unscrewed the cylinder head nuts and lifted off the head itself. Then we began scraping the carbon from the inside of the head and from the tops of the pistons. I want to be away by 6 o'clock, my father said. Then I'll get to the wood exactly at twilight.
Why at twilight? I asked.
Because at twilight, everything inside the wood becomes veiled and shady. You can see to move around, but it's not easy for someone else to see you. And when danger threatens, you can always hide in the shadows, which are darker than a wolf's mouth.
Why don't you wait until it gets really dark? I asked. Then you wouldn't be seen at all.
You wouldn't catch anything if you did that, he said. When night comes, the pheasants fly up into the trees to roost. Pheasants are just like any other birds. They never sleep on the ground. Twilight, my father added, begins about 7:30 this week, and it's at least an hour and a half's walk up to the wood. I must not leave here later than 6 o'clock.
Are you going to use the sticky hat, or will it be the horsehair stopper? I asked.
Sticky hat, he said. I'm very fond of sticky hat.
When will you be back?
About 10 o'clock, he said. 10:30 at the latest. I promise I'll be back by 10:30. You're quite sure you don't mind being left alone?
Quite sure, I said. But you will be all right, won't you, Dad?
Don't you worry about me, he said, putting his arm around my shoulders and giving me a hug.
But you said there wasn't a man in your dad's village that didn't get a bit shot up by the keepers sooner or later.
Ah, my father said. Yes, I did say that, didn't I? But in those days, there were lots more keepers up in the woods than there are now. There were keepers behind almost every tree.
How many are there now in Hazel's Wood?
Not too many, he said. Not too many at all.
As the day wore on, I could see my father getting more and more impatient and excited. By 5 o'clock, we'd finished work on the baby Austin, and together we ran her up and down the road to test her out. At 5:30, we had an early supper of sausages and bacon, but my father hardly ate anything at all. At 6 o'clock precisely, he kissed me goodbye and said,
"Promise not to wait up for me, Danny. Put yourself to bed at 8 and go to sleep. Right?"
He set off down the road and I stood on the platform of the caravan watching him go. I loved the way he moved. He had that long, loping stride all countrymen have who are used to covering great distances on foot. He was wearing an old navy blue sweater and an even older cap on his head. He turned and waved to me. I waved back. Then he disappeared round a bend in the road.